Pub History, the show that brings you fascinating stories from Boston history. This is episode 34, Boston and the Golden Age of Piracy, part 1. Yar, matey! I be Jake!
And I'm Nikki. This week, we're going to talk about Boston's role in the Golden Age of Piracy, which stretched roughly from 1650 to 1726. A few pirates set sail from our city. Some preyed on the shipping coming in and out of our port, and even more met their ends on the gallows in Boston. We'll hear stories of daring raids and buried treasures, of mutiny, jailbreak, and double-crossing.
Shiver me timbers! Haul to and prepare to be boarded!
Are you going to keep that up the whole time?
I'll try to control myself.
Okay. Before we talk about pirates, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is June 26th, and on June 26th, 1833, Harvard honored President Andrew Jackson, the short-fingered vulgarian of his era, with an honorary degree. As he started his second term, President Jackson was already a wildly controversial figure. By this time, he had run roughshod over the Constitution, ignoring a Supreme Court decision and expelling the Native American tribes of the Southeast along the Trail of Tears. And he had caused an economic depression with his attack on the national bank system. In his first election in 1828, he had soundly beaten the sitting president in an ugly populist campaign. That sitting president was local boy John Quincy Adams, and he was now a university overseer at Harvard. Adams and a number of other notable alumni chose to stay home during the 1833 commencement rather than see Jackson honored by the university. Adams' diary records his reaction to the invitation extended by college president Josiah Quincy and his resistance to the idea of normalizing Jackson's presidency. I said that the personal relations in which President Jackson had chosen to place himself with me were such that I could hold no intercourse of a friendly character with him. I could, therefore, not accept an invitation to attend on this occasion. And independent of that, as myself an affectionate child of our alma mater, I would not be present to witness her disgrace in conferring her highest literary honors upon a barbarian who could not write a sentence of grammar and hardly could spell his own name. Mr. Quincy said that he was sensible how utterly unworthy of literary honors Jackson was, but the corporation thought it was necessary to follow the precedent and treat him precisely as Mr. Monroe, his predecessor, had been treated. As the people of the United States had seen fit to make him their president, the corporation thought the honor which they conferred upon him were the compliments due to the station, by whomsoever it was occupied. Mr. Quincy said it was thought also that the omission to show the same respect to President Jackson, which had been shown to Mr. Monroe, would be imputed to party spirit, which they were anxious to avoid. I was not satisfied with these reasons, but it is college ration and college sentiment. Time-serving and sycophancy are qualities of all learned and scientific institutions. Quincy presented the president with his honorary degree as Doctor of Laws, with a short address in Latin. Jackson's reported to have responded, "Ex post facto, e pluribus unum, sic semper tyrannis, quid pro quo," which proved Mr. Adams right in his opinion of Jackson's intellect.
Today, we live in an era of 24/7 global news coverage, but a century and a half ago, the pace of news reporting was practically glacial. As we discussed in our episode about the Patriot printer Isaiah Thomas, if a newsworthy story happened outside your town or city, reporting would wait until your local newspaper publisher exchanged papers by mail with the publishers in surrounding areas, read through them, and decided what news to publish in the next edition. If something newsworthy happened overseas, forget about it. It would take weeks or likely months to make it into your local paper. In the spring of 1846, there was a development that slashed the amount of time it took to report European news in American newspapers. A telegraph line opened that connected Boston to New York. Telegraph inventor Samuel Morse had been born and raised in Charlestown before creating the first telegraph in 1832. The technology spread slowly, as the range and cost-effectiveness of telegraphy was improved through the 1830s and early 1840s. In 1846, with relays perfected, the telegraph network began to march down the East Coast in earnest. It reached from Boston to Springfield, and then Hartford, then New Haven, before finally linking Boston to New York on June 27, 1846. This was important to the news business because so much of the publishing business was already concentrated in New York City. However, the Cunard Line steamers from Europe arrived first in Boston. With the help of the telegraph, a news broker in Boston could go through the mail and newspapers an ocean liner brought from Europe and write summaries of the foreign news. Papers and magazines in New York would subscribe to their updates. Thus, the concept of a wire service, like the Associated Press, was born. In fact, some accounts of the AP's history link it directly to the establishment of the Boston to New York telegraph lines.
Wednesday is June 28th, and on June 28th, 1775, an important precedent was set at the headquarters of the Continental Army in Cambridge and the seat of the Provincial Congress in Watertown. General Artemas Ward issued an order that said, "The Committee of Safety are hereby ordered to deliver out arms to such commanding officers as make application to them for the same." He probably should have either requested the arms or ordered his officers to apply for them. Having been issued an order by a military officer, the civilian government embodied by the Committee of Safety took exception. The committee apprehend that it is of vast importance that no orders are issued by the military or obeyed by the civil powers, but only such as are directed by the honorable representative body of the people from whom all military and civil power originates. And though this committee are satisfied that General Ward has misunderstood said resolve, and does not mean or intend to set up a military power above the civil, yet lest this order of the generals should be adduced as a precedent in the future, we think it our indispensable duty to protest against the general's said order. Notwithstanding which protest, we also think it our indispensable duty to deliver said arms, agreeable to the spirit of said resolve, and as the exigency of the public requires, and submit our conduct to the Honorable Congress. This precedent was carried forward by Elbridge Gerry and James Madison at the Constitutional Convention, was defended in the Federalist Papers, and continues today. Today, civilian control of the military is considered a foundational requirement for a nation to be considered a democracy.
On June 29, 1919, a crowd of at least 50,000 people gathered at Fenway Park to hear an address by Eamon de Valera. Valera had emerged as a hero of the 1916 Easter Rising, narrowly escaped execution at the hands of the British authorities, and was now acting as president of the fledgling Irish Republic. He was on an American tour, trying to get the federal government to recognize his country, floating loans to support his republic, and courting the favor of the American people, especially Irish Americans. On the latter front, his stop in Boston was a success. The next morning, the Globe would report. To say that it was thrilling is putting it mildly. It was electric. The heart and head of the people of Irish blood were in it. In Eamon de Valera was personified the fulfillment of their hopes and the very mystery which attaches to this man, who was comparatively unheard of until recently, somehow fulfilled the dreams of the race, that some great figure would arise at the crucial moment and lead Ireland to freedom.
Friday is June 30th, which is the anniversary of an important institution in Boston. On June 30th, 1689, King's Chapel opened in its current location at the corner of Tremont and School Street. King's Chapel was the first Anglican church in Boston, and it was opened despite resistance by the colony's Puritan authorities, largely due to pressure from unpopular Governor Edmund Andros and the royal government back in England. A corner of a Puritan burying ground was set off for the purpose because the locals refused to sell any land for a dissenting church, and a small wooden chapel was built. That wooden structure would stand until the 1750s, when the current stone building was built around it. Then the lumber from the old building was taken out through the windows and doors of the new building. After it was removed, the wooden chapel was rebuilt as an Anglican church in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia. The original structure was greatly expanded in Lunenburg, and remained in use until it was destroyed by a fire on Halloween night in 2001. The church is being reconstructed on the footprint of the original, and original components are being used as much as possible, including a few fragments of the wooden structure that originally opened in Boston 328 years ago this Friday.
That's not the only connection between Boston and the town of Lunenburg, Nova Scotia. In June of 1782, a group of four Massachusetts privateers met in Boston and decided to sail together to raid the British towns on the coast of Nova Scotia. Captain Noah Stoddard, aboard the schooner Scammel, was given overall command of the fleet, and he was joined by the Hero, Hope, and Dolphin, with a total of 170 men. If you need a reminder, privateers were ships that were owned and operated by private individuals, but had authorization from a government to attack and capture enemy ships during wartime. Appropriately for today's topic, privateers were just one letter of authorization away from being considered pirates by both sides. Despite their marginal legal and moral standing, privateers were vital to the Patriot cause during the Revolution. There were 1,697 American privateer vessels, as compared to just 64 in the Continental Navy. The privateers and Captain Stoddard's little fleet arrived at the fishing town of Lunenburg, Nova Scotia on July 1, 1782. The town consisted of about 50 houses and a few hundred people, though they did have a militia, a small fort, and a series of reinforced blockhouses. There was a detachment of British regulars as well, a corporal and six whole men. At daybreak, the fleet landed at an uninhabited bay about 2 miles from Lunenburg. 90 men went ashore and started marching toward the town. The ships, now manned by skeleton crews, sailed for Lunenburg Harbor. As the landing party arrived in town, they traded shots with the regulars who had holed up in a blockhouse, eventually capturing them. A group fanned out through the town, arresting as many militia leaders as they could find, while another group exchanged fire with some militia who had gathered on a hill outside town. As the ships arrived in the harbor and brought the town under their guns, the militia of Lunenburg agreed to lay down their arms if privateers would spare the town. With that, the Americans had free rein in the town. They stole anything that was useful, destroyed anything of military value, and left much of the rest in ruins. A historian records, "They showed a special fancy for the scarlet regimentals of the militia and the silver-hilted dress swords. Dry goods, provisions, gunpowder, whatever would be useful to them was carried on board their vessels. The king's stores beside the wharf yielded rich booty in ration beef, pork, and flour. The powder and ammunition from the magazine were transferred to the Scammel's hold. 20 puncheons of good West India rum mentioned by the Boston Gazette must have been welcome. The town itself was a spectacle. What the Americans did not want they destroyed or left laying about. An eyewitness reported the narrow streets strewn with laces, ribbons, cottons, and many other kinds of shop goods." The raiders left the town before sunset and long before British reinforcements could arrive from Halifax. They commandeered some of the vessels anchored in Lunenburg Harbor to carry their booty back to Boston, where they arrived by mid-July, selling off their cargoes and dividing the profits.
Finally, Sunday is July 2nd, and James Thatcher's Revolutionary War Diary records an important anniversary on July 2nd, 1775. I am informed that General George Washington arrived in our provincial camp in this town on the 2nd of July, having been appointed by the unanimous voice of the Continental Congress at Philadelphia, General and Commander-in-Chief of all the troops raised, and to be raised, for the defense of the United Colonies. He was in General Braddock's defeat in 1755, and having had considerable experience in the wars with the French and Indians on the frontiers in former years, he is supposed to possess ample qualifications for the command of our army. And the appointment gives universal satisfaction. All ranks appear to repose full confidence in him as Commander-in-Chief. The next day, under the Washington Elm on Cambridge Common, General Washington officially took command of the Continental Army. Now we turn back the clock to the earliest days of Boston and to the roots of piracy in New England.
During the early days of the Golden Age of Piracy, New England waters were an afterthought to the buccaneering opportunities to be found in the Caribbean. These were the days of the Spanish Main, when treasure galleons from Spain's Central and South American colonies were preyed on by French and English vessels. Many of them had started out as privateers, with letters of marque from the French or English crowns authorizing them to attack the Spanish enemy. Others were simply drawn by the promise of gold. The French, Spanish, English, and Dutch were major naval powers, but the corners of their empires were far flung and growing quickly. It was easy for pirates to harass shipping lanes outside the watchful gaze of any nation's navy. With or without letters of marque, the traditional hostility between the great powers made an excellent pretense for attacking the shipping of an enemy nation. While the Caribbean seemed to be saturated with pirates, the rich fishing fleets, commercial trade routes, and lightly defended port towns of New England drew their fair share of pirates during this early period. The very first pirate known to ply the waters off New England made his mark just 2 years after the town of Boston was founded. Dixie Bull was born in London and moved to the village of Boston in 1631. Bull worked as a trader, sailing the coast of Maine in a small shallop. In June of 1632, he was trading in Penobscot Bay when a small group of Frenchmen attacked his vessel, taking all his trade goods. Dixie Bull returned to Boston with revenge on his mind. According to John Winthrop's journal, he raised a company of 15 more of the English who kept about the east. And with this crew, he sailed north, looking for French vessels to attack. Unfortunately, he found none. With the summer waning, his supplies largely used up, and no Frenchmen to be seen, Bull turned pirate. His crew attacked and plundered two or three English trading vessels, similar to his own, to get needed supplies, and they forced a handful of men to join their crew or be killed.
Having once gone pirate, there was no going back. To be caught would mean certain death at a hangman's gallows. Dixie Bull only upped the stakes, making the decision to attack a lightly defended port town. His crew sailed into Pemaquid, Maine, and looted a trading post there, getting all of their loot back into the shallop without resistance. However, just as they weighed anchor, a shot rang out from shore, and Bull's second-in-command fell dead. The first sight of blood seemed to shake Bull's confidence in the pirate life, and he tried to convince the next captain whose vessel he captured to navigate his shallop to Virginia. Puritans at the time considered Virginia a nest of rogues, whores, dissolute, and rooking persons, so it might have seemed like an attractive pirate hideout. The captain refused this request, so Dixie Bull and his crew continued attacking Maine trading posts. On November 21st, 1632, word of Dixie's rampage reached Boston. Governor John Winthrop received a letter from Captain Walter Neal of Piscataqua telling him of the raid in Pemaquid. In his journal, Winthrop notes that he agreed to send his bark with 20 men to join with those of Piscataqua to take said pirate, but snow, frost, and contrary winds prevented them. The following May, a ship from Boston sailed for Pemaquid in search of Dixie Bull, but he was never found. Some accounts say he sailed for the east and pledged his allegiance to the French, while others say he made his way back to England, where he was captured and executed.
After the disappearance of Dixie Bull, the waters off New England were quiet for almost half a century, though there were pirate attacks on English shipping in other parts of the world. These made the folks here in Boston nervous enough to pass a law specifically banning piracy and making it a capital offense, where Puritan Massachusetts would have previously relied on Mosaic law. In October of 1673, the Great General Court of Massachusetts passed the following law. The court, observing the wicked and unrighteous practices of evil men to increase, some piratically seizing of ships with their goods, and others by rising up against their commanders and seizing their vessels and goods at sea, for the prevention whereof, and that due witness may be borne against such bold and notorious transgressions. This court doth order, and be it hereby ordered and enacted, that what person or persons soever shall piratically or feloniously seize any ship or other vessel, whether in the harbor or on the seas, or shall rise up in rebellion against the master, officers, merchant, or owners of any such ship or other sea vessel, every such offender, if found in this jurisdiction, shall be apprehended, and being legally convicted thereof, shall be put to death. However, the first major pirate to be brought to Boston for trial after that law went into effect managed to not only escape execution, but even to go on to a future career as an officer in the Royal Navy.
By 1689, Thomas Pound had lived in Boston for 3 years. He came here as a junior officer on the HMS Rose, serving as a pilot and naval cartographer. The people of Boston rose up against Governor Edmund Andros in April of 1689, which you can hear more about in Episode 6. During the chaos, the captain of the Rose was thrown in jail, and the local militia cut down the ship's topmasts and took her sails to keep her from assisting Andros in any escape attempts. This left Thomas Pound unemployed and bored. On August 8th, Pound and 5 companions boarded a small ship out of Bull's Wharf in Boston. They paid Captain Thomas Hawkins for passage to Nantasket. Then they said that they'd changed their mind and wanted to do some fishing. As they were anchored near Lovell's Island in Boston Harbor that night, a small boat came up beside the larger vessel. 5 armed men rushed aboard, and Pound and his friends also pulled out concealed guns. They took command of the ship, threw the fishing gear overboard, and told Captain Hawkins to set a course for the open ocean, where Pound's men planned to take over the first vessel they could find and sail for the Caribbean to raid French shipping. This must have seemed like a fine plan to Captain Hawkins, because he chose to throw in his lot with the pirates. Together, they hailed the first fishing boat they saw, but seemed to have gotten cold feet. Instead of taking over, they just bought a small store of dried mackerel and some water. Only a few hours later, and still within Massachusetts Bay, they surprised another vessel, a fishing ketch. This time, they did take over the ketch, without firing a single shot. They moved their men and gear onto the new ship, then turned the fishing crew loose on the original boat, so word quickly reached Boston that there were pirates on the bay. From this point on, Pound commanded the expedition, while Hawkins piloted the ship. They made a course north to Falmouth, Maine, at the site of today's Portland. Somehow, Pound had prearranged a signal, and a corporal and several soldiers deserted from the local fort in the dark of night to join Pound when he arrived in the harbor, with all the powder and guns they could carry. It seems as though Pound and Hawkins just couldn't wait until they got to the Caribbean to begin their piratical career. With this complement of men and arms, they began attacking ships along the Maine and Massachusetts coast on August 16th, flying a red flag.
Upon capturing their next prize on Cape Cod, Pound set the captain free and told him to take a message to Boston, that they knew the government sloop lay ready, but if she came out after them and came up with them, they should find hot work, for they would die every man before they would be taken. The gauntlet had been cast down, and the great and general court wasted no time sending ships in pursuit. Two vessels cruised in search of the pirates unsuccessfully, while Pound and Hawkins continued to raid the New England coast. Finally, in early October, a sloop of war named Mary cornered the pirate crew at Tarpaulin Cove in the Elizabeth Islands off the southern tip of Cape Cod. A brief but desperate fight followed, in which Pound was struck by several musket balls, and the captain of the Mary was killed. Finally, the pirates lowered their blood-red battle flag and were taken prisoner. On January 13, 1690, Pound, Hawkins, and 9 others were sentenced to death in Boston. The sentences for all 11 state that they were to be hanged in Boston on January 27th, but Pound and Hawkins were ordered to be taken back to London for their executions. As the ship was in the mid-Atlantic, a French privateer set upon them. In the heat of battle, the British captain released the two prisoners from the brig, asking if they would fight to save the ship. They agreed, and by all accounts fought bravely. Hawkins was killed in the battle, along with about 10 of the ship's crew, while Pound made it safely to London. With the endorsement of the ship's captain and the recommendation of former Governor Edmund Andros, Pound's death sentence was commuted, and he was soon released from prison. He rejoined the Royal Navy, becoming captain of the frigate Sally Rose in August 1690.
Just a month after Thomas Pound was captured at Tarpaulin Cove, the Eleanor, a ketch that had just sailed from the Caribbean with a cargo of sugar and indigo, was riding at anchor in Boston Harbor. Most of the crew was on shore trying to make arrangements to get the cargo unloaded, while the passengers stayed on board under smallpox quarantine. When the authorities finally agreed to let Captain William Shortriggs bring the ship in as close as Castle Island, he returned to the harbor and was shocked to see that the Eleanor was gone. While he was away, a small boat had come up alongside carrying a man named William Coward and 4 accomplices. They quickly subdued the sickly passengers and made off with the ship. The next day, they ran the ship aground on Cape Cod and abandoned it. Soon, William Coward and his band were arrested and brought to Boston for their trial. All 5 were found guilty and sentenced to hang on the same day as Thomas Pound and Thomas Hawkins. The sentences for the 4 accomplices were commuted, while William Coward went to the gallows in Boston on January 27, 1690. Why did Coward hang in Boston, while Pound and Hawkins were sent back to London for their executions? I think the answer can be found in the famous story of Captain Kidd.
Captain William Kidd is one of the most legendary pirates in history, but his time in Boston is almost a footnote to that storied career. Kidd was a native of Scotland, who moved to New York City as a young man. He lived on Pearl Street in Manhattan, married a wealthy widow, and became a prominent citizen while serving as a privateer against French shipping. At one point, he received a commission from the governor of Massachusetts to pursue a French privateer that had been harassing ships coming in and out of Boston. But he was unsuccessful. While in New York, Captain Kidd became acquainted with Lord Bellamont, who was the royal governor of New York, New Hampshire, and Massachusetts at the time, as the Dominion of New England was slowly dissolving and returning to government by each individual colony. Lord Bellomont had an ambitious proposal for Kidd. English ships sailing from New York and Boston were being preyed on by pirates, not in the waters off New England, but halfway around the world on the Indian Ocean. Lord Bellomont and a group of investors outfitted a fine 34-gun ship for Captain Kidd and arranged for him to get a royal commission to attack pirates, freebooters, and sea rovers of what nature soever. Kidd and his crew would then divide the spoils they took from these pirates between themselves and their wealthy sponsors. Kidd sailed out of New York Harbor on September 5th, 1696, with orders from Lord Bellomont to serve God in the best manner you can. And after reaching the place and station where you are to put the powers you have in execution, and having effected the same, you are, according to agreement, to sail directly to Boston in New England, there to deliver unto me the whole of what prizes, treasures, merchandise, and other things you shall have taken. I pray God grant you a good success, and send us a good meeting again, concluded the noble earl. Nearly 3 years passed with Kidd out on the seas. Rumors began to swirl in Britain and America that Kidd had overreached his letter of marque as a privateer, and was now acting as a pirate himself. Other accounts said that Captain Kidd himself was acting true to his commission, but a group of his men had mutinied and begun acting as pirates. With Kidd off the shore of the Arabian Peninsula and Madagascar, only third and fourth-hand accounts reached Boston and New York. Was Captain Kidd the most vicious pirate on the high seas, regularly attacking ships belonging to the British East India Company? Or was he an honorable privateer who preyed on pirates of all nations for the benefit of the British crown?
Nobody would know until 1699. In May of that year, Lord Bellomont finally chose to visit Massachusetts after being appointed governor of the province 4 years earlier. Just weeks after he arrived, a messenger came bearing unexpected news. Captain Kidd was back. His ship was in Delaware Bay, and he was on his way to Boston to uphold his end of the deal. Bellomont offered him clemency, and Captain William Kidd arrived in Boston on July 3, 1699. The governor soon went back on his word, ordering Kidd's arrest for piracy, a crime which carried the death penalty. Kidd claimed to have proof that all the ships he had attacked fell within the parameters of his royal commission, but Lord Bellomont would not allow the evidence to be presented. Thus, Kidd was to be shipped back to London to stand trial at an Admiralty court. And this explains why some people who were accused of piracy would be tried and executed in Boston, while others were sent to London. A pirate like William Coward could be tried and hanged in Boston because his crimes were exclusively committed in Massachusetts and the surrounding waters. Someone like Captain Kidd or Thomas Pound attacked ships in international waters and preyed on ships belonging to other countries. Crimes like those had to be tried by the Admiralty Court, which had jurisdiction over all maritime offenses committed on the high seas. In April of 1700, William Kidd was taken back to Boston, where he would be tried and convicted of murder and piracy. On May 23, 1701, he was hanged at Execution Dock. On the first attempt, the rope broke, but the second attempt was successful. After his death, Kidd's body was gibbeted, meaning that it was dipped in tar, wrapped in chains, and then hung up in public as a deterrent to future pirates. He hung over the River Thames for 3 years. After this drama, the British government made changes that would allow pirates to be hanged without the trouble of bringing them to England. But before we hear about what changed, we should meet Captain Kidd's very interesting cellmate at Boston's Stone Jail.
When Kidd was thrown in jail in Boston in 1699, he would soon be joined by another pirate who had been on quite an adventure. Joseph Bradish was born in Cambridge in 1672 to one of the first families of the town. He became a sailor, and at 26 years old, he boarded a ship named Adventure in the port of London for a cruise to Borneo. While most of the crew was ashore on Polonus Island getting water, Bradish and a small group cut the anchor cable and sailed away. The crew divided the rich cargo between themselves and elected Bradish captain, as he was the best navigator aboard. In the spring of 1699, they made their way to New England waters. Coming ashore at Block Island, the crew purchased two small sloops and sank the Adventure. Sailing along the New England coast, the crew slowly dispersed, one at a farmhouse here, two in a port town there, taking their treasure with them to finance new lives in a new land. Finally, just Bradish and 10 men were left in one of their sloops, and they decided that it would be safe to chart a course for Boston Harbor. They were incorrect. The sudden influx of rough sailors with unexplained wealth along the coast had not gone unnoticed, and word had reached Boston of Bradish's pending arrival. Just before their arrival, Lieutenant Governor William Stoughton issued a proclamation on April 1st, requiring all justices of the peace, sheriffs, constables, and other officers and subjects to arrest Joseph Bradish and his accomplices, who belonged to the crew of the ship Adventure of London. Of between 300 and 400 tons, mounted with 22 guns, Thomas Gulick, commander, being on a voyage from London on to Borneo in India in the year of our Lord 1698, and who piratically and feloniously did seize and run away with the ship and her lading, on to Block Island, within His Majesty's colony of Rhode Island, where said Joseph Bradish and his accomplices have sunk the said ship and dispersed themselves into diverse parts and places, such persons to be proceeded against as the law directs, given at the Council Chamber in Boston, the first day of April, 1699. Soon, Bradish and his crew were guests in Boston's imposing stone jail, a dungeon-like building with 3-foot-thick stone walls, iron spikes set in the doors, and iron bars across the glassless windows. The structure was so impenetrable that the door keys themselves were almost 18 inches long. It was not, however, impenetrable enough to hold Joseph Bradish. On the evening of June 24th, just about a week before Captain Kidd's arrival, those iron-spiked doors of the stone jail were left wide open, and Bradish and a one-eyed man named T. Weatherly walked out. The Boston jailer at that time was a man named Caleb Ray, and unbeknownst to anyone, he was Joseph Bradish's uncle. While a reward was offered for the capture of Bradish and Weatherly, charges were brought against Caleb Ray. July 25th, 1699, advised and ordered that the King's Attorney General be and hereby is directed to make inquiry into the escape of Joseph Bradish and T. Weatherly, committed for piracy, and to raise a prosecution against Caleb Ray, late keeper of his jail in Boston, for the same. Eventually, a sachem of the Kennebec tribe named Essecambuit sent word to Boston that Bradish and Weatherly had been captured north of Saco, Maine. They were back in Boston by October 26th and joined Captain Kidd in the stone jail, where he had arrived while they were on the lam. This time, there was no relative to help them escape. Caleb Ray was found not guilty of helping Bradish escape, which would have been a high misdemeanor, a breach against the peace of our sovereign lord the king, his crown and dignity, and the laws. Bradish was put on the same ship to London as Kidd, and he would eventually be hanged at Hope Dock in London.
The British authorities made a guinea pig out of the next member of our rogues gallery, testing their new method of dealing with pirates that didn't require them to be shipped back to London. Jack Quelch had been the lieutenant commander of the Charles, a privateer that sailed out of Marblehead in the summer of 1703, with a letter of marque from Governor Joseph Dudley. Their orders were to ply the waters off the coast of Canada and attack any French or Spanish-flagged vessels they came across. The crew, however, had a more profitable scheme in mind. Before they even left Massachusetts Bay, they threw the captain overboard and elected Jack Quelch as their new captain. Turning south, the brigantine Charles sailed to the waters off Brazil and hoisted the black flag of piracy. Captain Quelch and his crew captured at least 9 Portuguese vessels, many of which were carrying rich cargoes. Before long, the hold of the Charles was full of Brazilian sugar, hides, cloth, guns, gold dust, and coins. While Portugal was not included in their letter of marque, the crew felt that their vast treasure could buy them goodwill back in New England, as long as they were able to keep the murder of their captain secret. In the spring of 1704, Captain Quelch turned the ship towards Massachusetts and home. He made no attempt to disguise himself or the ship, sailing proudly home with a hold full of spoils. Unfortunately, while Quelch and the crew had been at sea, Queen Anne had signed a treaty of alliance with the King of Portugal. Without knowing it, the crew of the Charles had been preying on the ships of a new ally. The brand new Boston newsletter carried a notice of the crew's arrival in Marblehead in May of 1704. Arrived at Marblehead, Captain Quelch in the brigantine that Captain Plowman went out in, and said to come from New Spain and have made a good voyage. What they didn't say is that the crew had just divided up their share of the Charles's loot and hit the town with pockets bulging with gold. They drew a lot of attention, and between their violation of a treaty and their indiscretion on shore, Governor Dudley quickly issued arrest warrants for the crew.
By late May, 25 of the original 43 crew members were in custody. There had been a dramatic chase and a showdown when some of the crew got a new ship in Marblehead and headed out to sea again. A company of Essex County militia surprised them on the New Hampshire coast as they were burying a stash of gold, just like a scene from a children's pirate story. The Essex men got the upper hand, and the pirate crew was thrown into Boston's Stone Jail. On June 13th, the trial began, and this is Captain Quelch's true claim to fame. His was the first Admiralty trial to be held outside of England proper. An Admiralty trial had many implications. First, it meant that he would be tried under maritime law rather than the law of the province of Massachusetts Bay. And it meant that there would be no jury and no right to representation. Jack Quelch stood before his judges, the governor and lieutenant governor of Massachusetts, the lieutenant governor of New Hampshire, an Admiralty judge, a customs collector, and the province secretary. Despite there being no right to representation, an attorney was assigned to help Quelch with his case. He claimed that he had only followed the orders of the governor, but his argument fell on deaf ears. Three members of the crew had agreed to testify against him in return for clemency, and they accused him of murder, piracy, and attacking Allied shipping. Quelch was convicted and sentenced to death, along with six other members of the crew of the Charles. 15 threw themselves on the mercy of the court and were sentenced to serve in the Queen's Navy. On June 30th, 1704, the condemned men were marched through the streets of Boston. A long, silver oar, symbol of the British Admiralty, led the procession from the Stone Jail near the site of the old State House to Scarlet's Wharf at the foot of Fleet Street in the North End. There, the six men mounted the gallows, and all but Quelch expressed words of repentance. The pirate captain, however, still felt that his actions had been justified, and issued a defiant warning. "Gentlemen, 'tis but little I have to speak. What I have to say is this. I desire to be informed for what I have done. I am condemned only upon circumstances. I forgive all the world, so the Lord be merciful to my soul. They should also take care how they bring money into New England, to be hanged for it."
In the early decades of the 1700s, piracy changed dramatically. Of course, Admiralty courts started operating in Boston. But the end of the War of the Spanish Succession also meant that a new generation of pirates took to the seas. These newcomers were less likely to prey on the Spanish Caribbean and more likely to raid the waters of the Carolinas, Virginia, and New England. They had names like Black Sam Bellamy, William Fly, and Blackbeard. We'll meet them in Part 2 of Boston and the Golden Age of Piracy. To learn more about pirates on Boston Harbor, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/034. We'll post pictures of the tall ships that visited Boston Harbor last week to illustrate the types of ships our pirates would have sailed, and we'll link to a number of books and online resources about the Golden Age of Piracy. For more on Captain Kidd's career outside Boston, we'll have a link to an episode of the Bowery Boys podcast on his life in New York, and we'll have a hardcore punk song about him called The Gibbeted Captain Kidd. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're at Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and now also Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. While you're on this site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on iTunes, we'd love it if you could write us a brief review. It is the best way to help others find the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next week with an Independence Day show about World War I, patriotism, and the Boston Symphony Orchestra. Then the following week, we'll pick up our pirate tale.